We're coming now to the final session of the conference. We hope to use this session to summarize and knit together some of the other themes that so many of you have brought to what I believe has been a very fruitful conference. I'd like to refer to one of the speakers you heard at the beginning of the Mormon General Conference on Sunday. You'll perhaps remember the address that was given right at the beginning by Elder Henry B. Eyring. He was the first speaker after the conference started. I've long been influenced, and I've quoted in these sessions before some remarks that I once heard him make. You would not necessarily know this, but he was someone who earlier in his life had received a doctorate in business administration from Harvard and had a distinguished teaching career, teaching and practicing principles of business management. And from him I learned that there is empirical evidence that unless you write down action items at the end of a conference, practical results are unlikely to follow. So, I've also heard him speak in the past about the importance of listening to messages and acting on what come to you as impressions. And I hope that all here, delegates, participants, staff, friends, will think about what we have learned and what we can do and write it down. Our prophet Joseph Smith once said, "There is or was a vast store of revelation that has been lost simply because people didn't take the time to write it down." So, with that in mind, you will find two pages in front of you, and I was a little nervous because they were waiting deferentially to pass these out for my request, and I had hoped they would put them there so you would find them there when you got here. These are two pages of evaluations. One is for us and one is for you. The first page is a short, unless they've stapled them in the wrong order, but I think the first page is a symposium evaluation form. And I'm going to actually take a minute and go over that now, because it's in English, and I realize this is less helpful for some of you. So I'm going to just ask that the interpreters read, as I'll read the questions, just you can just note what the questions are if you're not English speaking. There's a little chart at first. I'm just going to go down, and you can rate things. That's transportation, hotel, hosting, meals, Sundance. You haven't been to the Humanitarian Center yet. Interpretation, conference facilities, and the conference theme. Then there are short questions. Maybe you can just make a note of what the gist of the question is and then give us some notes. Comments on any of the above, or general impressions of the symposium. That's number one. Number two, what comments do you have about the symposium theme, panels, and sessions? By the way, you can write these in your native language. As you know, we've developed ability for the most part to translate these. Which of the activities were most meaningful to you? That's number three. Number four, what's the most important insight you gained from participation in the conference? And five, do you plan to take any specific actions as a result of what you've heard? And if so, what? So that's the first page, and that I hope you'll just tear this off, write some notes as appropriate, and leave those. And if you have time later and have additional comments, we welcome those. We learn every year. And I could only tell you, you couldn't imagine the difference between this conference and conference number one. We've learned a lot. So we appreciate your comments and help on this. Now, on the second page, this is the page to be taken with you. It's intended for you to use to write down things that you have the sense that you should do in coming days. We hope you will find ways to put into action some of the ideas you have had while you are here. If there's anything that we can do to be of assistance, or you think that we might be able to do together in the future, write it down and let us know. One of the great things about these conferences over the years is the kinds of partnership and joint action that it has fostered. Now, a very practical thing that I'm telling you now, while I know everyone has interpreters that needs them. One of the first things you should write down on the second page, and do this for sure, write down the words luggage tags. Put my luggage tags on my luggage when I pack. Tomorrow morning many people will be leaving after the events tomorrow, but we move everyone from the hotel to Salt Lake City. You will either end up on airplanes tomorrow afternoon or at a hotel there where you can easily make connections on Thursday. Your luggage tags ensure that your luggage will get to the right place when you need it. So, very important. Put my luggage tags on my luggage when I pack. And if you are missing luggage tags or don't know what we're talking about, you'll be able to get them tonight at the dinner. But don't forget that note. Okay. Second note. We're doing something a little different this year. There's been a picture list that you could pick up, pictures and bios of the participants. But all of this information will be on our website. But there are going to be two things. The picture list does not have email and contact information. And we understand that information should not be, for many of you, on a public website. However, we know that many of you would like to have information about other people participating in the conference. And so our plan is to have a page on the website that we will send you a link to this. It will not be publicly accessible, and it will have a list of people's coordinates, email, and so forth. So you'll get that as an email when you get home in a few days. Some of you, I know, are in sensitive positions, and for a variety of practical reasons, it may not work for you to have, even on that kind of more private website, to have your coordinates. If that applies to you, and just let us know, let Deborah know, or you've all got Deborah's email coordinates, or you'll get them when you get this email. Just let us know if there's a problem. Most people would like to have the participant list so you can keep in touch with people, but we want to respect people's wishes on that. Okay. Now, at this point, I would like to express a few words of thanks. Well, we're thankful to all of you for the time you have given for these conference days. We're thankful to Justice Yaak Zakub for his thoughtfulness in the opening session in expressing gratitude out of order. We think that was appropriate. I think gratitude is never out of order. And in some senses, it is an attitude of being and should become a well from which all our actions flow. So let me express some added thanks now. We know you have traveled far, left family and loved ones behind, and left desks that are accumulating work at home while you've been gone. And we also know of the intensity of your contributions here. One of the things we treasure about this conference is the opportunity to provide, that it provides to make deep and lasting friendships. Think of some of those of you who I've known for a long time and am extremely grateful for that. We also have opportunities to grow in sympathy and compassion for each other's challenges. I'll always remember being at a conference in Romania one year, and the head of religious affairs was there, and I was criticizing some of his actions as usual. And finally, in desperation, he just looked at me, looked at the audience and said, "I'd like to see Professor Durham manage my desk for one day." So I have trouble managing my own desk, so he struck a fair response. The point is, one of the things I have learned by getting to know so many of you is some of the challenges that you face and the decisions that you have to make, how difficult they are, how much you care about them, and how much we learn from you as we discuss these together. Certainly, each of you has blessed our lives by your mere presence, by sharing your thoughts and ideas, and adding in countless ways to the success of our conference. Now, there are a lot of people who have been given, and they've done so much. I'm going to try and mention as many as I can. I'm sure I'll forget some. I'd like to, first of all, express thanks to the student volunteers, to the executive committee. This is really an incredible group of students, and this year has been really unmatched. They have, you have seen what they add, everything from holding the signs to meeting you at the airport. What you haven't seen is the countless hours behind the scenes, the minute-by-minute plan of the conference that's about that thick, and the incredible work that they have done. Second, we had a remarkable hosting group this year, many from this community, but many who have come from other parts of the country to be here. Our hosting committee has been led by Linda Neron and Lynn Anderson. I think they should both stand. I see Linda and Lynn. Also, I'd like to recognize Lynn Madsen, who's the center historian for our center, and Dwayne Madsen, who's the chair of our International Advisory Board. And they've been, two of you should stand. You've seen them. Among other things, they've been working with us to make a photographic record of our proceedings. They've done many other things as well. I'd like to especially also mention the other members of our International Advisory Council. Many have come from long distances, and many are here because of their great love for your countries and for the principle of religious freedom. Third, we owe a special vote of thanks this year to Judge J. Clifford Wallace. Let's see, am I seeing him? There you are. You should stand up for a moment. Cliff has been one of the longtime supporters of the conference. He, after about 17 years, actually missed one, but only because he had to be at a very important judicial conference meeting somewhere else. But he is, as you know, we've had a judicial track, as you could say, in this year, and this could not have been set up without his generous time and his connections and all that he has done to make that possible. There are also several people here at the law school that need to be thanked. This starts with the dean and faculty members. Well, and I should suppose the students. The students haven't, they've given up this week of class to have a break. What was harder, though, is to make room for the translation services. They had to move classes around some last week. So there's been a lot of support from the law school community as a whole. Gary Buckway and Vance Everett from Media Services have played a vital role. Lori Anderson at the BYU Travel Office has done a lot of your tickets. We owe special thanks to John Moran from Audiovisual, to Denny Elder, who's been our producer, and Darren Brown, our program manager. The two of them together have managed all that goes with translation and preparing the audio streams that are being recorded. And finally, Fabio Sagabin, who has supervised translation. And of course, none of this would work without our interpreters and those who have translated many items in advance. So if we could thank that group. We owe special thanks to Bill Atkin, the Associate Counsel for International Affairs of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who has been helpful in countless ways, as well as those working with him and those who have provided assistance from the Church's Department of Public Affairs. On our own staff, several people have been crucial. Elizabeth Clark, the Associate Director of the Center, who has assumed overall responsibility for management of this conference, deserves special credit. She's had countless late nights, but everyone in our center gets involved. Bob Smith is managing director, Brett Scharfs and Gary Doxey as associate directors, Don Luthayer is our managing editor, Marshall Maurice, our website development manager, Gayla Sorensen, who works with many volunteers for the center, Dave Kirkham and Scott Isaacson, who are senior fellows and area advisors, and then our secretaries, Jessica Thomas, Ellie Savage, and finally, last but certainly not least, Deborah Wright, who all of you and all of us owe a special debt of gratitude for her countless hours. In the time we have left, I want to divide this in two parts. First, I've asked a number of those of you to make some brief comments, just to get one of the really hard things about this conference is deciding which of the split-out sessions you will go to. You can take some comfort from the fact that if you're really diligent, you can go home and these will be a lot of these are taped and you can listen to them on the internet, but it's a hard choice. And so we hoped that we could benefit from having a number of people who could just make some comments from various perspectives. This is not intended, there's no possible way we could summarize everything that's been going on, but I thought by picking some people from various regions and with various backgrounds, we could help bring back to mind some of the impressions that are important. So I'm just going to call on people and hope if they can come down quickly, and I will restrict them to 5 minutes maximum. They get bonus points if they're at three. This is someone representing the audience. This is David Rodarmel. David has been a speaker in past years, and for 3 years he worked in the Office of International Religious Freedom in the U.S. State Department. So this is the office that writes the international reports every year for the U.S. government. He's here in his personal capacity this year as a member of the audience, and if he could come first, and then he'll be followed by Mariata Bangura and then Judge Anthony Penrose Randerson, and maybe the two of them could come up and be sitting up here as well. So.
Well, distinguished delegates, my assignment in the Office of International Religious Freedom ended last summer, about a year ago, but I got in the habit of coming to these conferences and enjoyed them so much that I have made the journey again from my current assignment, which is in Stuttgart, Germany. I was struck by the theme of this conference. In my experience, the U.S. policy has been to, in accordance with its International Religious Freedom Act of 1998, to promote international religious freedom as a point of U.S. foreign policy, but not in the sense of attempting to get other countries to adopt our interpretations of religious freedom, but rather engaging countries on the basis of agreements that they have adopted, international agreements, international standards. And I think I was struck in this session, in this symposium this year, on how we really have a ways to go yet in our various countries and cultures in deciding what those international standards are. Each of our societies, communities, countries may have differing interpretations. And that was particularly, I think, brought home in the presentation yesterday of Mr. Chief Justice Zaki Azmi of Malaysia, where he talked about the practicalities of applying a national law to decisions, even if that national law may have its own unique interpretations, may be different from how some others interpret the law in accordance with other perhaps interpretations which may or may not be accepted by other nations in the international community. So we still have, I think, a way to go in working together in our pluralistic world, but I do believe that encounters such as this one help us greatly along that road in making that journey. And I thank you for the opportunity to meet with you.
So next, Marietta Bangura from Sierra Leone, Ministry of Social Welfare, Gender, and Children's Affairs.
I want to thank you all for inviting me to this session. Of course, it has been very inspiring. It has given me an insight into the different religions around the world and how people perceive religion. From the discussions, I learned that religious problems are not just for religious sake, and they do not relate to the beliefs or the practices. The problem most times stem from our cultural and political gains. We want to, because of political ends, we use religion to achieve it. And most of it has been thrown out. We have seen most of it in the discussions and the presentations, that religion per se is not a problem. The main problem is politics, and politics is creating a problem for our religious beliefs. Also, I've been privileged to meet a lot of people from different backgrounds, lawyers, accountants, and I think I'm going to make a lasting relationship with them. And of course, one thing again that really strikes me from this this symposium is that there is a need for each country to have a sort of a melting pot, like what we have in Sierra Leone, the Inter-Religious Council, to actually discuss issues relating to religion, to see how they can bridge the gap. They should act as a mediator in order for religious tolerance to exist in all the regions. And I think I believe if we have it, like my colleague in Nigeria, they have it, we have it in Sierra Leone, and I believe the other regions can make good use of an interreligious council to settle disputes among religion. Of course, the law is there, but when there's a council or some melting pot to mediate on cases, I believe the tensions will be cooled off. And another thing that really fascinated me was the volunteerism of the students. I was really touched in the way they actually acted as a host. They've been really wonderful to us. And I believe as delegates, we should take that home with us. It should be part of us to make sure that whatever we do it in the best interest of the people and not for a selfish end. Indeed, it has been a pleasure, and I'm going to take all of what I've learned to my country, We intend to do a code of conduct for religious leaders, because of late we've been having problems. But from the experience I've learned here, I believe I'm in a position to actually influence and advise my seniors back home as to how we can do a religious code of conduct for all the people of Sierra Leone. I thank you.
So next, let me call on Judge Anthony Randerson, who is representing our judges.
Well, thank you, Professor Durham. As a newcomer to BYU and the Center for Religious Studies, coming here from a small country far away has been a unique learning experience for me and for my wife and others who have come from our part of the world. So we've been overwhelmed with the generosity of your welcome here and the hospitality that we've been shown throughout. I must say that not coming from the academic world, I've been deeply impressed with the level of learning and expertise which your Faculty of Religious Studies has assembled, not only here, but your ability to have contacts with people from all around the world, as far away as Ukraine and other places that have not traditionally been part of the Western world. And it can only be for the good, it seems to me, that those contacts have been made and nurtured, and that continues. We in New Zealand, I think, can count ourselves pretty lucky that by and large, in a small population, we haven't had any significant problems. But you don't have to look far away. I mentioned something about the Pacific and some of the entrenched social attitudes and cultural problems there. Of course, we've heard from other areas in Muslim countries and in Africa and even in South America, the sorts of opposed views that people have on religious issues. And it must seem at times for those working in this field to try to improve understanding that the problems are overwhelming. But that shouldn't, I think, be a concern and should certainly not be putting people off. On the other hand, it does seem to me that this is a problem or a challenge, perhaps is the better way to put it, which has been around for a long time. It's going to be around for a lot longer. And we shouldn't imagine that through our own efforts in our generation and lifetimes that we will solve all the problems of the world in this field. I sometimes think of the issues in New Zealand that we've had to resolve with the Maori people, the indigenous people of New Zealand. They have historic grievances which are steadily being addressed by a very constructive process. But in acting personally for some of the Maori tribes who have been making claims, I've said to them, well, I'm sorry this is taking so long. And the response is, well, we've waited 150 years, what's another few years? And I think maybe in this field too that we should be thinking that what we need to do in our generation is to do our best, but to recognise that it's not going to resolve all the problems and that future generations will have to carry on the work that has been begun and so successfully to date. The other short point that I wanted to make as a matter of overall impression is that the study of religion is important in itself. But in the end, it's the manifestation of the religious differences around the world and the social consequences that there are from restrictions on freedom that come not only from secular society and governments and other religions. And it's those social implications or manifestations that are to be tackled. And while the academic studies that are done here so successfully are vital and critical to that process, there are also other dimensions, social, economic, political, and legal, that have to be tackled as part of this overall process. And if there's one thing that I'm sure you have steadily in mind and don't need telling from me, it is that one needs to tackle these issues on a multifaceted basis, so that those other dimensions can be brought into play in every forum where they are relevant. Our efforts in symposiums such as this may need to be expanded and extended to include those wider sectors. And at the end of the day, any one of them is not going to be successful. The courts, for example, that I'm most familiar with, we can make grand rulings, there can be grand statements of principle by international bodies, but in the end, it's people that is going to solve the problems that and challenges and education, which is going to promote understanding and tolerance and hopefully make the world a better place. Thank you once again for the honour and privilege of being invited here. I'm pleased to have been able to play a small part in this much wider project. Thank you.
So we'll next hear from Eugenio Cedeño, a deputy in the Chamber of Deputies of the Dominican Republic's National Congress. And after him, we'll hear from Brian Grimm and Vicente Linares, so they could be coming forward. Yep.
Gracias. Para mí y para los compañeros y compañeras delegados de República Dominicana que nos acompañan.
To me and to those delegates who are with us, it has been a great honor to participate in this symposium. I have participated in many international events. I've been in New Zealand, Japan, China, El Salvador, and Chile. And I've participated in events where topics have been discussed and which have served to but mainly extend the confrontations between countries. But here I have found a group where there is a group of warriors for peace and an institution that works for peace in the world. And the great thinker and founder of Mexico, Benito Juarez, he said that the respect for the rights of others equals peace. And this is a topic that has to do with with human rights. All the people in the world, all of the human races, all human beings, in the beginning, the first right that we had was that of worshiping divinity. And that's what we're struggling to do here. That's what we've been dealing with this primordial, this principle, human right to be able to have the religion that we want to have. And this is a right to which we are all committed to defend. This has also been a great opportunity for me to provide my vision of the importance of religious freedom. And respect for religious freedom is the highest form of expression of respect to the state of law and the fundamental rights of people. We have been treated wonderfully the transcendent topics that have been discussed, and I leave with a great impression and a different vision of what the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is. Until this point, I had some very strange ideas, but I leave very impressed back to my country and to my wife. And we have had an experience and determination here, and in the Dominican Republic, we've made progress in the terms of religious freedom, country where the colonizing country, Spain, imposed religion upon us. And this progress that we have made there is something that cannot be stopped. We leave with the determination to introduce to the Congress of our country to propose a new law of religious freedom. And I believe that this is something that we can accomplish through the legislators that are down there, including the three legislators in my country who are here. And I want to, and one of the presenters of this event, the gentleman from Argentina, I don't remember his name, I'm sorry, Gentile, that it is necessary that the regional bodies, and he said that there had to be an international treaty. I believe there has to be several international treaties for presenting documents and commitments, regional commitments, for fostering religious freedom in all of our nations and for creating an instrument that other states can adhere to in order to promote religious freedom in our countries and among our people. From the bottom of my heart, thank you very much. And this wonderful experience that we had in the assembly in the tabernacle is something that I'll be taking with me. Thank you very much.
So next we'll hear from Brian Grimm, representing the non-lawyers among us, and then Vincente Linez, representing some lawyers among us. And after him we'll call on Reverend Thomas Phillips, and then Jorge Horacio Gentile. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm a social scientist, and I've been working on social scientific measures of religious freedom, or the restriction on religious freedom. And I have to confess that I have been influenced by some lawyers along the way, one of which is sitting to my right. As I was developing these indexes when I was at Penn State, I read an article by Cole that was discussing how favoritism of religion and restrictions on religion could both be a restriction on religion. And that influenced me and some of the measures that I created that continue to this day. So I have appreciation for the work that he's done in the past. And it's been a true honor to be part of this group. This is probably one of the most amazing conferences I've ever been to, not just for the logistics and all of that, but the focus on an issue that everyone is concerned about and the way that we could share ideas. And so learning so much from each of you has been a great opportunity. And one last bit of praise before I make a few comments on trends that I think are important to watch is the work that has been being done in China for the past several years. Judge Wallace was there, and it was wonderful to spend time with you, helping to train lawyers in China, and also getting to know about you and Brett Scharf's up there. just spending time together and trying to help others get an idea of how religion and law can work together. So it's been an honor, and I think the work being done here is not only top-notch, but cutting edge as well. So I have a couple notes on trends to watch in the coming years from a social scientific point of view and possibly legal point of view. The first is that issues of religious freedom affect us all, that harassment and abuse related to one's belief or religion is something experienced by all faiths, including people with no faith, who choose to have no faith at all. So whether we're religious or non-religious, these matters affect all of us. And I think it's a common concern that we can share. And as I showed in my data, that Muslims experience this nearly as much as Christians do around the world. So it's not limited to one religion facing these problems. Now, there's three trends that I'm watching and I think are useful to watch as in the years to come. First is that globalization is resulting in greater pluralism in many countries than was experienced some years ago. And this brings new pressures for religious freedom. And this is particularly seen in countries of Europe where there's been immigration in the past decades, particularly of new religious groups, including Muslims, to many European countries. And we've seen a rise in social hostilities involving religion related to the trying to accommodate these new faiths into the European setting. And it's not just that one dimension, that as these new faiths come in, they also may be bringing some of the prejudices and beliefs from where they've come from. So some new faiths have come in that are more anti-Semitic than were, so we've seen than the general population. So we've seen a rise in anti-Semitism in a number of countries of Europe. So this can go both ways, both tensions toward the immigrants, but some of the tensions the immigrants themselves bring. A second trend to watch is religious protectionism, the idea to guard our nation or a nation against the dangerous religions that are trying to affect us. And this is nowhere more clearly seen than in blasphemy laws or apostasy laws or anti-defamation of religion laws. And that the direct connection between these laws and extremism is seen in some places. For instance, in Pakistan, where blasphemy laws carry the death penalty, or blasphemy can carry the death penalty. Two politicians that were trying to repeal these laws, the governor of Punjab and also the minister for minority affairs in Pakistan, were both assassinated just because they suggested that these blasphemy laws should be repealed. So the extremism was triggered by the laws that are supposed to help control extremism. So this protectionism is an important trend to watch. And the third trend to watch that we've seen in the data is a polarization where countries that have high restrictions or high social hostilities involving religion have tended to get a bit more restrictive or a bit more hostile. Just two examples. Egypt was already very high, had very high government restrictions, but in our data we're seeing that the restrictions are increasing. Nigeria, we saw social hostilities involving religion, maybe not caused by religion, but involving people of different religious groups was high, and we saw it increase during our period. So these are concerns to watch. And then the last note I'd make is that these trends are useful for governments. As you go back to your countries, please feel free to share the report, and I'd be glad to correspond with any of you on these matters and even visit some countries if there would be an interest. But three examples in China, the strong government restriction of religion was meant to control social hostilities, but despite those high restrictions, social hostilities have gone up according to our data. So that's something that the Chinese government is interested to see. In Denmark, where there's general openness, we've seen an increase in social hostilities, and their leading newspaper is carrying a story based on the data and trying to understand what this is related to. And if you'll remember, that's the country where the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad were first published, and there were some tensions there. And then finally, I don't think I shared this the other day, but the leading English newspaper in Turkey covered our report when it came out in August, and their headline was, "Good news, restrictions on religion in Turkey did not increase." So we showed that our data show that restrictions on religion in Turkey are high, and They didn't get any higher, and the newspaper was reporting good news. So that's our hope, that these data can become somewhat of a measure that people can look at and say, what is the condition of our country on these matters, and which direction are they going? And that's the hope, I think, for any social scientist, is that the research we do can be of use to people in trying to assess the social situation and then look at what they might do in response. Thank you.
So, Vincente, and then if, we're going to run out of space up here, so I apologize, but then Reverend Phillips, and then Professor Gentile.
First of all, let me thank all of the delegates, of course, for being here, but also our hosts. I think that as we have seen throughout these sessions, religious freedom is a very complex problem. Its analysis evolves from considering public transgressions or public limits to it, private limits to it, transgressions from other religions or other religious groups, and even passive transgressions. The simple maintenance of status quo, especially in countries where there are confessional states, is in itself a transgression of religious beliefs and is felt by important minorities as a transgression. So we have to thank our hosts for giving us an open forum where not, as Brian was saying, not only were all the infrastructure and facilities provided to us so that it was as pleasant as possible, and so everyone was in at their best, but also we were all imbued in, and I am not a church member, but in the environment on the philosophy of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I have to say that the respectful and considerate and selfless manner of the church members is the ideal setting for an academic discussion. Having participated in many academic discussions in my home country and in other fora, I can tell you that many times secular fora are more repressive than this place where we are. So I thank the church authorities, the authorities here at Brigham Young, and congratulate you, because this is a true academic and a truly free forum. On the legal side, my main observation, and with that I will leave you, is that it appears that these complex problems that are posited to us by freedom of religion are very hard to resolve strictly from the perspective of individual freedoms. Our international treaties, our constitutional texts, fall short when faced with analyzing problems, putting a repressed party on one side and a repressing party on another. Maybe they don't fail all the time, because there are some good examples, but they make for very hard analysis. And paraphrasing someone who spoke before me, I think to attend to this need of humanity, this essential, and to quote and to paraphrase Justice Yacoub, something that is so essential to human dignity, we need to pull out, as they say here in America, all the stops. So I leave you with the thought that regulation of organizational manifestations of religion and the promotion of organized religions in all our countries is a tool that needs to be more focused on, more analyzed, and more exploited. Thank you again to all for all your kindness, and let's hear what everyone else has to say. Thank you.
So Reverend Thomas Phillips from Malaysia, he's the Secretary and Vice Chairman of the Christian Federation of Malaysia and President of the Malaysian Council of Buddhism, Christianity, Hinduism, Sikhism, and Taoism. He may represent more than all of us.
Let me start by saying, dear friends, because it's the feeling that I get after coming here. When I first had a call from Elder Howard in Malaysia, that he represents the Church of the Latter Saints, I was a bit skeptical and I was a bit tensed up when he asked for a meeting, because the image that we have always got of the Mormons is something negative. And when I told my friends and my church members that I'm going to Utah, oh my, you're going to beware of that country, beware of the Mormons. And oh my God, what am I getting into? So that maybe that's why I didn't want to come alone. I thought I'd bring my wife along with me. But interestingly, after a long journey, and I come to the gates after the airport, I meet a volunteer. And this atmosphere of meeting me, this friendly nature, really impressed me. And this, you know, I felt so comfortable coming to the hotel, meeting the people. It was so impressive in the sense that I lost my tiredness. I felt excited. I felt there was something new that I'm going to face. And suddenly I get a call that Professor Cole is going to invite us for dinner. And that is something unusual, because we come as delegate, we meet at a conference and we just leave. And it was a good experience that you know some of the members of the church met together. And we are able to share together. And my wife is always quiet, who always hesitant to speak. She cannot stop speaking now when she meets others. She finds it so comfortable, so open, and so natural. And that's the atmosphere of this whole conference that has given us. I speak from a religious point of view. I come from a multi-religious, multicultural society. And we have always been defensive. Protect your rights. Claim your rights. And we always are not looking at the other person. We are looking in terms inward, looking in the terms of thinking of ourselves and claiming our rights. But after coming to the conference, I see and hear that each of us in our own country have our own struggles. That we have the same struggles that we have to move along. And that has opened my boundaries. See, I have to break off from my exclusiveness, which I claim for myself or my church. I need to understand humanity, and that is one of the things that I've learned when I became the president of the non-Islamic religious group. When we stand on issues, we have common issues, and it's all about human rights and basically about dignity, and which gives us the peace. We make claims that our religions are, you know, the will of God. It teaches us of compassion. It teaches us about love. It teaches us about embracing one another. The very religion that is supposed to bring unity to mankind is a very religion that is basing conflicts in society. And this theme that is brought up and bringing people from various parts of the world, in fact, I'm meeting my Chief Justice for the first time personally in this conference, because whenever judgments on inter-religious issues makes and we make statements criticizing the issues, the way the judiciary makes their claims and make their judgments. And one thing that I've learned and realized is what when the Chief Justice said, it's the politicians who legitimize certain things, and the judges become helpless, and they are not able to do anything about it in a helpless situation. That makes me aware that we are also the culprits by not choosing the right politicians to sit in the parliament who make laws. I think these are things that we need to educate our people, our members out from the pews, from the pulpit. So the changes are not by just through violence, by getting the right people in the right places to speak out. And I'm really fascinated by the trip to America. You see, when I meet members of the Church of the Latter Saints, they asked, how many children do you have? I say, only three. And I was embarrassed to say three. I thought it was too much. But then someone says, seven, eight. I get a shock of my life. Then when you say you don't smoke, you don't drink even coffee, I was really, hey, this is something different. See, it's a condition in the mind that we have put ourselves in that we are not able to come out of the mindsets or the trappings that we build, that we are not able to reach out to the other person. And that is what I've learned, and that is what I appreciate in my stay here. I appreciate the fellowship, and I appreciate everything that I've learned, and think this has enriched my life and my journey of faith. And when I talk about conversion, it's not about other person being converted. My engagement with everyone is a conversion for myself. I was impressed by Justice Viacco with his statement when he started off. It was impressive in his contributions. And these are things that goes into our mind. I'd like to record my appreciation, my thanks for the wonderful experience that I have, and I'm sure that in the leadership capacity I have, I can carry much more things that I've learned to go back to share with my fellow Malaysians, hoping that we will be also better persons by encountering people who have gone through the same experience. Once again, thank you, all of you, for making our stay and our learning process a great success. Congratulations to the organizations.
So finally, we'll hear from Professor Jorge Horacio Gentile from Argentina, former judge, former member of parliament, eminent scholar.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much. I became very interested when I was invited to come to this forum because I really had a lot of doubts in my life with regard to this topic. The first great doubt that I had was imagining what happened to the first Christians and to Christ's Jewish fellowmen when he said, "My kingdom is not of this world," or when he told them that give unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is of God. And that doubt would surely, because of tradition and the years that the Messiah had waited, had to be very big. And I don't know if that doubt has dissipated over these past two millennia that have gone by since the arrival of Christ. And I'm one of those who has doubts in this regard. And my main reason for coming here was to get rid of those doubts, along with other, with fellow Christians, with Jews, with Muslims, and with people of other religions. This doubt has helped me greatly in everything that has been discussed here, but perhaps at that time it was clear what was of Caesar and what was of God. Today we live in a globalized world where Caesar does not make the decisions of every nation in which we live, and we do not have a world government. We aspire toward a world government, but we do not have it. We do not have a Caesar, but rather a globalized world. For that reason is why I have dared, with these doubts that I have, to propose this as an international treaty for religious freedom. That I know that many have said it, that it's a utopia, something that's very difficult. There are 32 countries of the 193 in the United Nations that are still religious societies, and still in the world there's persecution. There are still people who are in jail, people who have been sentenced to death because of reasons related to religious freedom. Perhaps in the constitutions or in some of the many standards, a solution to this globalized problem of religious freedom has not been found. For this reason, I have thought that back when I was a senator, something similar happened to me because I had the idea of proposing a bill for approving the Treaty of Tlatelolco. Perhaps my pacifist spirit wanted to resolve a very difficult problem in the world, which is the atomic issue, or the nuclear issue. And perhaps with all the opinions, I thought that it would be impossible to accomplish. It's very difficult. And when I had to study it, I found a project that was so difficult, which was the nuclear issue, to resolve. And so I presented it. I finished my period as a senator, and indeed, it was not approved. However, the following year, it was approved. Well, I believe that a treaty of this nature is definitely difficult to approve, but I don't know if it'll be more difficult that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, 3 years after the atomic bombs and World War II of the Holocaust, and the beginning of the Cold War, and it happened. And back then, the French ambassador, he came with an idea of not discussing the fundamentals. Let's get down to practical issues. And indeed, it was accomplished that communist countries, Christian countries, Muslim countries, democratic countries, Jewish countries approve this declaration, which has been a great conquest in the world, a great accomplishment in the world. Article 2 of that declaration speaks very clearly of religious freedom. In terms of the needs of the times back then, perhaps we won't have to come up with a similar process with regard to religious freedom. And this is why I believe that this treaty would have to have at least three chapters to it. One, with reference to the rights of people in terms of religious freedom, and a second chapter with regard to churches and religious institutions and their respective rights, and a third chapter, the creation, we still don't have a world government, the creation of a commission, of a committee, and a council that would be interreligious and international. There is no world government, but at least this would serve to interpret the provisions of this treaty that would declare the rights of religious freedom. And this will work also to replace what the United States has already attempted, which is religious freedom rights in the last years of the past century. A special treaty for religious intolerance, which has now changed name. Now it's the special treaty for religious freedom. And so this multi-body organ could help us in improving in terms of religious freedom. And this is why I thank all of you. This has really clarified many doubts that I had in this regard. And I believe that when we return in our religions, or at least in mine, the questions with regard, doubts with regard to religious freedom, often we're not the minority, so not everyone in our respective churches is that concerned about these topics. And I'm sure they will have to go and preach these issues, not only in our communities, so that not only in our communities, but also in the world, there will be religious freedom, so that we will all understand one another better as God's creations. May God bless you. Thank you very much.
Last night, after the dinner, my wife and I had the chance to visit our youngest daughter. And she and her husband have just bought a house, and last night was the first night that they had moved in and were actually living in the new house. The rooms were strewn with boxes. The beds were not yet assembled. It was fairly clear that their two sons would be sleeping in improvised bedding arrangements. We wanted to be able to say that we had been there on the first night in their home. My wife deserves a lot more credit than I do because she's helped pack the boxes and she'll help unpack them, and I've been here. But I'm very grateful to a pretty forgiving family for these frequent absences. But for now, I want you to spend a little time thinking about the image of seeing our children moving into new homes with some of ours and their dreams being fulfilled. We all have to think about the homes that are being built, the homes that our children will move into, the future that they will move into. We can't help thinking of things as concrete as physical homes that they will inhabit, but we understand that they will live in a very different world. Our children are forgetting how to spell because they are becoming so adept at texting. They are attuned to announcements like Apple's announcement today of the iPhone 4S, which you can go home and check your own cell phones about. They friend people on Facebook and scarcely know what it's like to talk to people directly instead of, you know, with these other electronic instruments. In this brave new world, there are tremendous new technological opportunities that I know we here at the center are trying to learn how to take advantage of. It's a world in which yesterday's science fiction has become today's reality, and the pace of change in today's reality makes us realize that we can't begin to imagine what the future is going to be like. But we know some fundamental things. We know that human beings have spiritual sensitivities. They have questions about the meaning of life, about whether there is a life beyond, about how to find happiness and fulfillment, about how to build good and harmonious societies, about how to achieve justice and avoid evil. We also can be sure that human creativity and freedom will find different, with those characteristics of human beings, we'll find different answers to these fundamental questions. And as a result, we, our children, and our children's children will live in a pluralistic world. This means that those of us engaged in the work of trying to understand the relationship of religion, law, and society will not run out of work. We may run out of pay. That's something that's a different issue. But we won't run out of work, and the contributions we can make will become more and more important. Now, let me say just a few things about two issues that have been running through our discussions here and in a lot of other conferences that I've been at lately. The first has to do with the autonomy of religious institutions. The second has to do with equality. In April of 1990, I was preparing to go on my first trip to Central and Eastern Europe. It was April. I think this was literally the night before I was leaving, and I heard that the Supreme Court had decided Employment Division versus Smith, which any of those of you who are American religion lawyers will know, is the case, the peyote case, in which the Supreme Court decided that any general or neutral law could overturn or override religious freedom claims, subject to a few exceptions. This was a really devastating blow to religious freedom in this country, or it certainly looked that way. I remember thinking, I hope very much that the East Europeans I'm about to see this don't hear about this decision for a very long time. But we live in an electronic world. They heard about it fairly quickly. Now, what happened in that case was that a stricter standard of protection of religious freedom was abandoned in favor of a notion that neutral and general laws once passed should override religious liberty claims. And this was quite different from what the law had been prior to that time. There were very strong reactions in this country, and I have to say, since most people sort of focus on what the Supreme Court does, a lot of people haven't noticed that, in fact, the Supreme Court hasn't been followed very closely on this one. It took about 3 years, but parliaments move slowly. Within about 3 years, they passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which sought to restore the earlier strict scrutiny approach to religious freedom. The Supreme Court didn't like that, so they held four years later that the Congress didn't have power to give the courts that much power. This was a strange switch. The courts are trying to give Congress power. Congress tries to give it back to the courts. But essentially, they held that Congress didn't have power to impose a tougher standard on the states, that stricter standard has remained in place with respect to federal legislation. And then the lesser known fact is that the majority of American states interpreting their own state constitutions have held out for the stronger protection of religious freedom, and really only a handful of states have followed the Supreme Court approach. Now, one of the things that actually gave great comfort to those of us who saw this federal, what was really seen, I think, as a significant erosion of religious freedom protections, one of the things that gave us great comfort is Justice Scalia's opinion in that early 1990 case left an exception for a set of cases that dealt with religious autonomy, with church autonomy, with the ability of religious organizations to have autonomy in their own affairs. One of the very significant implications of that notion has been the so-called ministerial exception, which has been supported by all of the federal appellate courts in the United States, which basically holds that where one is dealing with a religious community and its ministerial or ministerial-type personnel, where that happens, churches have autonomy in structuring, and they have some flexibility vis-a-vis normal discrimination laws. Now, there had been some debates, and it was thought what's happening, as many of you know, is this. There's a case being argued tomorrow in our Supreme Court, which will challenge the ministerial exception. When this case was being argued below, the basic argument was people thought that basically the ministerial exception would remain intact, but there was some question about who qualifies as a minister, who is sufficiently close to being something like a pastor or a priest that the churches really get to say who is going to be in those positions. What's happened over the past summer as the final appeals and briefs have been written is that the Solicitor General and those arguing against the church's position have taken the position that the Smith Rule of 1990 should now apply equally to the autonomy cases. That is, that the exception that was left protected at the time of the Smith's case, that should also be subject to legislative attack. My own view is that is a very a matter of really grave concern. There, of course, people of goodwill can disagree about this, but what's hard is that if this is in some ways the oldest part of religious freedom. People often don't realize this, but in the United States, the oldest cases dealing with religious freedom are really cases about church autonomy. And this strand in American constitutional is one of the oldest strands in religious history in general, because one of the key questions was always the extent to which religion could be independent from the state. And critical to that independence was being able to appoint the people who represent or work for the religious organization. My worry is that if the central citadel of religious autonomy is rendered open to legislative attack, particularly at the key leverage point of managing religious employment, the consequences could be devastating for religious communities. Allowing general and neutral laws to override individual conscientious objection claims without compelling justification is profoundly objectionable from my viewpoint, but in the end, has affected primarily relatively unusual claims. Religious autonomy is different. It's critical to every religion that seeks to pursue and implement its distinctive vision with authenticity. To lose the battle for religious autonomy is ultimately to lose the battle for religious freedom itself. But that battle can only be won if we engage at all the levels, from abstract theory through various levels of constitutional analysis to concrete case law. And one of the values of a symposium like this is to bring together minds that are thinking hard about these issues, that understand why they are hard issues, and that tries to understand and see some of the best solutions that we can find. Now, one can understand the appeal of the argument that neutral and general laws ought to be able to override religious freedom claims. That is, I can understand the other side of this argument. Fundamentally, it's an issue of equality. Why should an exception be made for religious groups? Why should an exception be granted for Rastafarians or for the Christian Education Society, as was talked about by Justice Yacoub in his keynote address, or for other religious groups? Doesn't that make religion a law unto itself? That's what Justice Scalia asked in Smith. Isn't that a recipe for anarchy? Now, I think my own view is what lies behind those questions is an understandable, but I think mistaken, notion of equality. It's a sense of equality that fails to recognize that society has an interest in recognizing and buttressing conscience, whether secular or religious. This is one of the most vulnerable of all aspects of human life in society, and demands our highest protections. If this vulnerability collapses, there are all kinds of bad things that can happen in its train. There will, of course, be limits, and I think the limits are actually fairly well articulated in the international limitation clauses if these are narrowly construed. But we need to protect conscience and the institutions which nourish conscience. Moreover, I think sometimes I think we have, there is a tendency to see what you could call the Smith situation or the appeal of general and neutral laws. You can see the situation as religions asking for an exception to the law. But what is the law? Is the law just what the legislators say it is? Or is the law the sum total of the legislation and the constitutional norms that are in the background, the deeper notions of justice that underlie our constitutional norms? And if that's true, it may be that the people asserting claims of conscience are not calling for an exception to the law, they are calling for understanding of the way that the law is contoured to take into account religious difference, to take into account the vulnerabilities of conscience. Now, I think we are, as I said at the beginning, all moving into new houses. We are moving into difficult times. We are seeing, I think for those who are religious, the assumptions in favor of religion that have been with us through so much of human history are being eroded, and so there are deeper questions about what the nature of the house should be. We have dark memories of religion. We have memories of the Inquisition. We have memories of oppression. And one of the things that is a little frightening that's been brought out by Brian Grimm's work, maybe it's Grim Prospects, one of the wonderful studies is one that looks across the world and recognizes, and I'm not going to have, I didn't have time to look up the exact statistics, you can check Brian's work, but a substantial number of countries on Earth, something like 30% or more, have high or very high restrictions on religious freedom. And because some of the largest countries on Earth are among those with high or very high restrictions, something like 70% of the people on Earth live in countries with such restrictions. This means there is a lot to do. And let us not forget, I would probably say that the US is one of the countries with fewer restrictions, but I've just talked about the fact that we face very significant concerns or risks about this fundamental value. So I think it's fair to say that this is a universal concern, something that we understand the importance of. And the situation is an interesting one. It's, in a way, it's a crisis, but it's an odd kind of crisis, because it's not one in which people are clamoring to attack religious freedom. Religious freedom, we just heard Professor Gentile suggest we should pass treaties in favor of religious freedom, and this is not an isolated position. But what happens, people say, of course we should have religious freedom, but there's some exceptions. And the exceptions are growing, and the ways that exceptions can be framed are expanding. And it's this erosion by exception that forms the crisis. So we're moving into new houses. We watch and worry about the houses that our children will move into. I believe that we need to find ways to build houses, a lot of different houses, houses that will make room for people of different beliefs to live in. There is a lot of talk about secular society, the importance of secular society, but in a way what's really important is having societies that genuinely respect the right of other peoples. And in a way, and I'm looking at Ture Lindholm on the front row here, one of the things I've learned from him is that in a way what's really critical is not that we have the same views, but that we know that we will protect each other in our rights to have our own views. That is really the fundamental thing. And what's vital is that means that there will be room, that the houses we're building, the societies we're building, need to have room for a lot of different ways of structuring the houses. Now, let me also say, these houses that are being built, they're like my daughter's. They actually have a lot of boxes. I'm thinking of Rachel Cohn's prayer at lunch today about quoting the importance of wisdom. There's a lot of wisdom that's out there in boxes, in books, in other areas, within religious traditions, sources within religious traditions, teaching us to care about others. And these boxes need to be opened, unpacked, and applied. Let me conclude with just a scriptural phrase. A few years ago, when we had this conference, we were in the middle of Ramadan, and this had some interesting impacts on the meals, as you can imagine. And it led me to think about fasting, and also, I suppose, more about, and you could take that as a representative of religious practice in general. And I read one of the great biblical passages on fasting, but you could think about it as religious ritual, religious practice, observance in general. And the question is asked, what kind of fast is really wanted by God. And Isaiah says, to undo the heavy burdens and let the oppressed go free, that ye break every yoke. That is part of what religion should really be about. And then there is a promise that comes to those who do that. It says they will be able to build the old waste places. They will raise up the foundation of many generations. They will be the repairer of the breach, the restorer of paths to dwell in. We face a lot of breaches in our society, a lot of breaches of faith, a lot of rupture of relationships. But what I think is vital for us to do is to learn how to undo heavy burdens in each of our societies. I've come to know that the people who come to this conference, each in their own way, in their own lives, in their own positions, play significant leveraging roles in their society to that end. And I'm convinced, and I've seen it in different places in the world, many places, that we can repair these breaches and that we can be restorers of paths to dwell in. I thank you for your participation and thank you for your work in support of that great cause. Thank you. So with that, the formal conference comes to an end. We will return. I need someone to tell me. We have a dinner fairly soon. I can't remember whether we've given you a chance to go back to your hotels or not. No, we just go straight. Okay. So you all know the drill, and we'll see you at dinner.